Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Wardell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Benwell. Chapter 22, Allison Salt. Some weeks had passed since Ingleby took over Tomlinson's claim, when one lowering evening Grace Colthurst pulled up her cayuse pony in the depths of the Green River Valley. Leaden cloud had veiled the peaks since early morning, and now the pines were wailing dolefully beneath a bitter breeze. A little dust of snow, fine and dry as flour, whirled about her, and the trail was hard as adamant beneath her pony's feet. The beast pricked its ears and stamped impatiently, for it had been bred in the wilderness and knew what was coming. Grace, whose fingers were growing stiff, relaxed her grasp on the bridle and looked about her observantly, but without uneasiness. She was some distance from home, and daylight was dying out unusually early, while few horses unaccustomed to the mountains could have scrambled over either of the trails. There were two of them, foot-wide tracks which climbed up and down steep hollows and twisted round great fallen trees, and she had stopped at the forking, though there was, she knew, very little to choose between them. The bush was a little thinner just there, but she could see nothing beyond dim colonnades of towering trunks that were rapidly fading into the gloom. The cold was nipping, and she shivered when the breeze dropped a moment. The silence was startling, and she felt it almost a relief when a low crescendo murmur, like the sound of distant surf, rose from the pines as the wind awoke again. Then a puff of powdery snow stung her tingling cheeks, and she shook the bridle and turned the cayuse into the lower trail. She had ridden to the mines at the head of the valley early in the afternoon, while her father walked by her stirrup, which, considering the nature of the trail, he had no difficulty in doing. Indeed, he had led and now and then dragged the horse up parts of it. There had not, as infrequently happened, been a dispute concerning the boundaries of a placer claim, and the commissioner had gone over to adjudicate. He was not a brilliant man, but he showed no one favor, and the whimsically expressed decisions, which he apparently blundered upon, gave general satisfaction, and are still remembered in the Green River Valley. It was also characteristic of him that he had saved more than one difficult situation, in which a logical exposition of the mining laws would probably have been unavailing, by a little free badinage. In the meanwhile, his daughter, whom he had bidden ride home, realized, without any undue anxiety, that it might be advisable to reach there as soon as she could. She was at home in the saddle, and rightly thought herself secure from any difficulty that might not be occasioned by the weather. The free miner is a somewhat chivalrous person, which is going far enough by way of appreciation, since the epithet which might suggest itself to those acquainted with his characteristics has little meaning in the land to which he belongs, where men have outgrown the need of meretricious titles. Still, when a thin white haze blotted out the dim colonnades and obscured the firs beside the trail, she strove to quicken the cayuse's pace a trifle. The beast was apparently already doing what it could, clambering up slopes of gravel, sliding down them amidst a great clatter of stones, and turning and twisting amidst tangled undergrowth. Now and then a drooping branch whipped the girl as she went by, or shook the snow that was gathering on it into her face, and the withered ferns smote smears of white powder across her skirt. Winter was closing in earlier than anyone had expected. And that night an arctic cold descended suddenly upon the lonely valley. Her hands grew numb on the bridle. All sense of feeling seemed to go out of the foot in the stirrup. And at last it was with difficulty. She pulled up the cayuse, which appeared as anxious to get home as she was. They had floundered round the spreading branches of a great fallen tree. And now there no longer appeared to be a trail beneath them. Grace shivered all through as she looked about her. The pines were roaring in the sliding haze. The air was thick with dust, not flakes of snow. Here and there she could dimly see a tree, but the white powder obscured her sight and stung her face when she lifted it. She could not remember having passed that fallen tree when riding out, nor could she recall how long it was since she had seen the narrow trail in front of her. Where it was now, she did not know, but there was at least the sound of the river on one side of her, when she could hear it across the moaning of the trees, and heading for it, she would probably strike the trail again. And once more she spoke to the cayuse and shook the bridle. She was becoming distinctly anxious now. Then a hazy object appeared suddenly, a few yards in front of her, and stopped at her cry, while in another moment, Ingleby was standing by her stirrup, and her apprehensions melted away. It was significant that she was by no means astonished. She felt that it was only fitting that when she wanted him, he should be there. The mere sight of his face, of which she caught a faint glimpse, was reassuring. "Do you know that I am very glad I met you? Where is the trail?" she said. Ingleby did not protest that it afforded him an equal gratification, and if he had done so, it would probably not have pleased her. Grace was critical, and rather liked the reticence, which was, it seemed, in harmony with his character. That is, since he had fortunately grown out of the evil habit of discussing social economics. "I don't think it can be far away. In fact, I was just trying to cut off a bend of it," he said with a little laugh. "It isn't exactly a pleasant night for a stroll through the bush," said Grace suggestively. "No," replied Ingleby, who fell into the snare. "Still, you see, they were expecting me at the bakery." Grace was by no means pleased at this. Certain observations Esmond had once let fall with a purpose had not been without their effect on her, and she remembered that the girl at the bakery was, it had to be admitted, pretty. It also appeared likely that she was what is now and then termed a forward. Grace's displeasure, which she did not, of course, express, might, however, have been greater had there been any delay in the man's answer. "Then if you will show me the trail, I will not keep you. I'm getting cold," she said. Ingleby took the bridle, and he and the cayuse floundered through what appeared to be a horrible maze of fallen branches and tangled undergrowth. In fact, Grace fancied she heard her skirt rip as they struggled in it. Then the bush became a little clearer, and they went on more briskly, up and down steep slopes and past dim blurs of trees, while soil and gravel alike rang beneath the cayuse's feet. How long this continued, Grace did not exactly know, nor had she any notion as to where they were. The only reassuring thing was the glimpse she had of Ingleby plodding on beside her horse's head, which was, however, quite sufficient. Still, civility demanded something, and at last she bade him stop. "I'm afraid I must be taking you away from the bakery," she said. Ingleby laughed. "I am, of course, not going there now." That should have been sufficient. But Grace was not quite contented. Compliments on her beauty seldom pleased her, but she liked to feel the hold she had upon those she attracted, and was not averse to having it explained to her. "No," she said, "then where are you going?" Ingleby appeared a trifle astonished, as though he considered the question quite unnecessary, which was naturally gratifying. "To the Gold Commissioner's residence," he said. "With my permission?" and Grace laughed. Ingleby did not look at her. He was apparently staring at the forest, which loomed through the whirling haze, a faint blur of vanishing trees. and he flung the answer over his shoulder. "I think I would venture to go without it tonight," he said. This was significant, but although the snow was certainly getting thicker and the cold struck through her like an icy knife, Grace no longer felt any apprehension. She was not unaccustomed to physical discomfort and peril, and there could be, she felt, no doubt of her reaching home safely while Ingleby plodded at the horse's head. He was young and by no means assertive, but there were men in the Green River Valley who shared her confidence in him. Still, the rough flounder through the brushwood was becoming irksome, and where the trees were smaller, she could not avoid all the drooping branches by swaying in the saddle, and at last she bade him pull up again. "We are a long while striking the trail," she said. "Yes," said Ingleby, without turning towards her. Grace leaned down and touched him. "Why haven't we found it? I mean you to tell me." The man made a little gesture, for he recognized that tone. "I'm sorry," he said quietly. "We have struck it and didn't recognize it. In fact, we must have gone straight across and left it behind us." Grace sat still and looked at him. She could not see his face. He was no more than a blurred, shadowy shape in the haze of sliding snow. Still, she could make out that he was standing very straight, with slightly tilted head, and she knew the intentness of gaze and look of tenacity in the hidden face which usually accompanied that attitude. His answer also pleased her. There was no attempt at concealing unpleasant probabilities, for the man spoke frankly as to one whom he regarded as his equal in courage and everything, except perhaps bodily strength. In the meanwhile, however, they were alone in the wilderness, cut off from all hope of succor by anything but their own resources in a haze of snow, while their limbs slowly stiffening under the Arctic cold. "Then what are we to do?" she asked. "Push on," said Ingleby. "The river must be close at hand to the right of us. That's why I'm keeping to the higher ground. I don't want to strike until we have passed Allison Salt." He wrenched at the bridle, but Grace had faint misgivings as they floundered on again. Salt in that country implies a fall or rapid, and the one in question was called after a prospector who had drowned himself and a comrade there. It swept down to the mouth of the canyon in a wild white rush, studded with great boulders that bruised and scarred the pines the flood hurled down on them, and what made it more perilous in the dark was the fact that the trail dipped to the brink of the smaller rapids at the tail of it. Indeed, it was often necessary to splash knee-deep through the slack of them along the shore, and Allison had come by his death through mistaking the big salt for one of the smaller ones on a black night. The man who fished him out of an eddy a week later said that Allison looked very much as though he had been put through a threshing mill. It was, Grace fancied, half an hour later, when they floundered down a declivity, with the roar of the river growing louder in their ears. It was with difficulty she kept in the saddle, as she was vaguely conscious that her skirt was rent to tatters, though she was too stiff and cold to trouble about that now. Even in the thicker timber, the snow was almost bewildering, and it was only now and then she could see Ingleby scrambling and floundering in front of her. He was evidently making his course by sound, for there was nothing that she could discern to guide him. Then somehow they slid down a bank, and there was a splash that told her the cayuse was in the water. Ingleby seemed to be struggling with the beast, but she could not make out why he did so, nor did it seem of any moment. She was dazed and bewildered and intolerably cold. There was a further splashing, a plunge, and a flounder. The water rose to her stirrup, and for a few horrible moments she felt that the beast was going downstream with her. It was evident by the depth that they were in the salt. She fancied she cried out in her terror, and that Ingleby shouted in answer, but the roar of the river drowned the sound. In another few seconds, however, the horse apparently struck rock with its hooves again. Then the water that had lapped about her skirt seemed to fall away, and in a frantic scrambling, Ingleby dragged the pony up the bank. The cayuse stood still, trembling at the top of it, and Ingleby was apparently quivering too, for his voice shook a little as he answered her half-coherent questions. "Allison Salt," he said hoarsely, "it should have been behind us. I never recognized it until the river swept my feet out from under me. I suppose I was dazed by the snow." Grace sat silent a moment. She knew that they had looked death in the face, for nothing made of flesh and blood could carry the life in it through the mad turmoil of rock and flood in Allison's soul. The roar of the river was very impressive now, and the man's voice had shown that he was shaken by some strong emotion, which was not personal fear. Then, as the crash of a grapevine against a stream swept stone rang through the deep reverberations, she bent down and touched his shoulder. The contact was momentary, but she felt a little quiver run through him. "Nobody could have recognized it on such a night. It was not your fault," she said. "I can't forgive myself. The cayuse got out of hand. I couldn't hold him. He was heading out into the stream. If that ledge hadn't been there." He stopped with a gasp, and Grace was glad to recognize that of the two, she was the one who showed less concern. She guessed what he was feeling, but could not restrain the desire to make certain. "Well," she said, "if the shelf of rock had not been there." Ingleby turned and seemed to be listening to the river. Perhaps he did it unconsciously, but the hoarse roar of the flood among the boulders was sufficient answer. "You were not cumbered with a horse that had lost its head. There is a little slack close to the bank," she said. The man turned and seemed by his attitude to be gazing at her in astonishment. "You can't suppose I should have scrambled out alone," he said. There was a suggestion of anger in his voice which Grace recognized as wholly genuine. She had met and formed her own opinion of the protestations of not a few young men in her time, and it was evident to her that while Ingleby's attitude became him, he did not recognize the fact. "You felt yourself responsible then," she suggested. "No," said the man slowly, "I certainly didn't, though it's clear that I was. I don't think I felt anything except that you were in the rapid." This also evidently perfectly sincere, but he seemed to pull himself up abruptly and laughed in a fashion that suggested embarrassment. "You will not remember that little speech. It's not the kind of thing one is pleased with afterwards, but in the circumstances it was, perhaps, excusable," he said. He gave her no opportunity for answering, but struck the cayuse, and they went on again. Still Grace had noticed the tremor in his voice, and she knew that he had meant exactly what he said, nor was she displeased at it. Then the thoughts and fancies which the moment of peril had galvanized into activity grew blurred again, and she was only sensible of the physical pain and the weariness and an intolerable cold as the man and beast stumbled on. Twice again they dipped to the river, which, however, scarcely rose to his knee, and after that there was only a sliding past of snow-dimmed trees, while by a grim effort she kept herself in the saddle. And at last, a light blinked in front of her through the filmy haze. The cayuse stopped, and Ingleby, it seemed, lifted her down. At least she felt his arm about her, and then found herself standing beside him before the commissioner's dwelling without any very clear notion of how she came there. It was only afterward she remembered with tingling cheeks how she had seen a miner walk away with a 140-pound bag of flour. Then they went into a lighted room together and stood still, gasping a moment with a distressful dizziness creeping over both of them. Ingleby apparently roused himself with an effort and threw the door open. "Keep away from the stove," he said a trifle faintly. "There's a chair yonder." He stood in the entrance, white with snow, looking at her. The blood was in her head now, and a most unpleasant tingling ran down through her half-frozen limbs, but Ingleby was a trifle gray in face. "You can shut the door in another minute or two. I may come back tomorrow to make sure you are none the worse," he asked. Grace looked at him with a smile. "You can't go away now." Ingleby turned and glanced at the whirling haze that swept athwart the light in the veranda. "I'm afraid I must," he said. "It would be difficult to get off the trail as far as the bakery, and there is apparently nothing I can do for you here. Somebody lighted the fire?"
"One of the police troopers," said Grace. "That doesn't matter. It is snowing harder than ever. You can't go away."
She had brushed aside the dictates of conventionality, and the blood was in her face, and a curious sparkle in her eyes. They had been close to death together a little while ago, and it was a long way to the bakery. Still, it was not this fact alone that impelled her to bid him stay.
"I'm afraid I must," he said slowly, as with an effort. "You see, there is something I have to talk over with Ledger. He expects me. Besides, it would be advisable to send back any of the boys who may be there to see what has become of the major."
Then he turned abruptly, and Grace, who had scarcely remembered the major, laughed curiously when he went out of the door. She knew now at least exactly what she felt for Ingleby. And had he stayed and declared boldly what his wishes were, it is probable that Colthurst would have been astonished when he came home. Ingleby, however, had gone away, and the girl was left standing, flushed in face, with the melting snow dripping from her beside the stove, which she remembered with some little satisfaction was precisely what he had told her not to do. Then, with a little disdainful gesture, she swept into the adjoining room.
Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western Adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaws.